Welcome to Open Spaces. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kdalska. Wyoming's only avalanche center, based in Jackson, is trying to bring together snow observations from community members in the eastern half of the state.
Before they go out, they can make decisions on what the snowpack may be like. It'll help guide their terrain choices, hopefully.
This past year, Wyoming's Make-A-Wish organization granted a pretty unique wish.
It, like, didn't almost feel real because I think it's been a dream of mine ever since I first saw the Tetons.
And we'll hear some holiday traditions from a few of our listeners.
Christmas is on 6 different continents, 18 different countries.
We're doing a first. We're going to go out and get a piece of sagebrush for a Christmas tree.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Every day, Wyoming Public Radio brings you the news, from the latest on the war in Ukraine to ongoing issues of climate change, energy, and the economy. Tune in for what's happening here in Wyoming, around the Mountain West, and beyond, with state and regional news updates during Morning Edition, Here and Now, and All Things Considered. And you can find the latest news anytime at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Stay informed with Wyoming Public Radio.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kdalska. Make-A-Wish is a nonprofit that works to grant the wishes of children with critical illnesses. Each state has their own chapter, and 2023 was a really good year for the Wyoming organization, which granted the most wishes it ever has in one year, 41. We take a behind-the-scenes look at one of those wishes. Back in 2020, Rowan Shea was diagnosed with a rare type of cancer that appears in soft tissue. He was just 11 years old. About two-thirds of the way through chemo, Rowan, his mom Jody, and his dad Alec met with some Make-A-Wish folks to brainstorm ideas.
I was really into the Cleveland Indians at the time, and I really wanted to meet Francisco Lindor, who was their shortstop at the time. So we were about to go, like I think it was like a week out before we were going to go, and COVID canceled it.
Shortly after, Francisco Lindor got traded. So Rowan started thinking of different ideas. A second wish, to meet a famous ski racer, got denied. And then finally, he brought up a wish that he wasn't sure the organization would grant, climbing the Grand Teton.
I think for the Make-A-Wish folks, that was the first time anybody's asked for something like that. And so I think that there was a little bit of a period of time where, one, they had to confirm that we were physically able to do it, not just Rowan, but us as well.
Most wishes are granted when the kid is still going through chemo or soon after. Because COVID delayed things, Rowan was able to consider a more physical adventure.
It, like, didn't almost feel real because I think it's been a dream of mine ever since I first saw the Tetons.
It finally got approved. And Alec says all the amenities that Make-A-Wish provided, like the guides, training, food, lodging, and travel expenses, made all the difference.
And so I often think about all of the other families that they deal with, that regardless of what the wish is, knowing that everything's taken care of, that's a really peaceful feeling.
And so when the Shea family woke up at 2 a.m. one day this summer at Lupine Meadows in Grand Teton National Park, they were able to focus on the goal at hand, summiting the Grand Teton. They climbed the majority of the ascent together, but 300 feet or so before the top, their guide said a tough decision needed to be made because weather was moving in quickly.
And he said, if we're going to get to the summit, we need to pick up the pace. Jody and I did not even hesitate. We both looked at Rowan and said, go. And he was like a bunny rabbit jumping in your driveway. I mean, you take two hops and he's gone.
The Shea family lives in Laramie, and they are an outdoorsy family. Rowan's entire childhood, they made a point to go out to the mountains to hike, ski, and climb. But Dad Alec and Mom Jody say this summit meant so much more.
It was an extremely emotional, because it was this almost this cap to this whole experience where we remember Rowan going through chemo and being at his weakest point and how we dealt with that. And now we're watching this kid 3 years later, incredibly strong, really had no trouble physically going up that mountain.
Then to have this opportunity as a family where we tackle something as a unit really was amazing validation that we came out okay. Certainly not unscarred, but okay and strong.
Alec and Jody say this experience has grown Rowan so much mentally.
He has this reserve tank now that he can tap into at any time when something gets tough. He can sit back and say, well, it's not chemo. It's not surgery. I can handle this. And so that, to me, the climb on the Grand was the first time that I was actually able to watch him tap into that.
Rowan agrees with his dad.
And I think in the same way, I have the same outlook on life than most 15-year-old boys do. But the little things, I have a different outlook on.
You know you're not invincible.
Yeah.
Okay. And they don't plan to stop there. This January will be 4 years that Rowan's been in remission, and the family plans to continue climbing mountains.
Yeah, yes, we're doing Mount Moran this summer, which is a little bit smaller of a mountain, but a lot more like harnessed climbing, a lot harder pitches.
They say every time they climb a mountain as a family, they'll remember the climb that gave Rowan his wish come true. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska. And now we turn to another organization that helps those in need. Organ donation saved Douglas resident Rhonda Hill's life. She's been an advocate for the Donor Alliance nonprofit since a kidney donation in her 30s gave her a new lease on life. On New Year's Day, Hill will represent the Donor Alliance and Wyoming in the Rose Parade hosted in Pasadena, California. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor is no stranger to organ donation. He gave a kidney to his father 5 years ago. Victor asked Hill about what it means to receive the gift of life.
Tell me about how you came to need a kidney in the first place.
Well, my story goes back quite a ways. I was diagnosed with juvenile type 1 diabetes in high school. I remember standing in the drugstore one day and they had a list by the cash register and it said, do you have diabetes? And I was looking at the list and I had every symptom on the list. I was like, that doesn't sound right. I didn't know anything about juvenile diabetes back at that time. It was in the 70s, mid-70s. Of course, the technology wasn't anything close to what it is today. So I kind of felt like I was against the wall. So it was very severe. I just kind of felt like I had a, you know, 2x4 between my eyes and spent the first year or so kind of in shock and denial, which didn't help my physical state. It took me a long time to accept it, learn about it, take care of it. And unfortunately, it did take a toll on my body. So by the time I was in my early 20s, I had already suffered from neuropathy and background retinopathy. My eyes weren't great. By my 30s, my kidneys went into early stage kidney failure. I was 37 or 38, and I had just heard horror stories about dialysis. I was just petrified to go on that machine. Dialysis was very painful. They had a hard time getting needles in. The needles are very large. They're very painful. They leave scars. You know, it kept me alive, but I have to say it was a miserable time. You never really feel great. It takes over your life. I went Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. So every other day I ran for four and a half hours. Oftentimes my blood pressure would bottom out and I'd pass out. So I was on dialysis about a year and a half and had been really discouraged. The average wait, I was told at the time, was about 3 years, I think. And I was very lucky to get my call after only 18 months.
Tell me about getting that call. What was that like?
My gosh, I remember it like it was yesterday. It's 23 years ago, and I still remember it like it was yesterday. I walked in my apartment, and I looked over at the answering machine when I walked in, and it's blinking. And I thought, it's 10:30, whoever it is, I'm probably in bed by now. I'm going to call them tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. And I remember standing at the foot of my bed, and I got into my pajamas, get ready for bed. And I had to get up in the morning at 5 to go to dialysis. And I just looked up and said, God, just, I can't take this anymore. Just get me to the weekend. And I climbed in bed and the phone rang and it was Denver. I got my life that night, that morning, that early morning, October 4th of 2000. That call literally saved my life.
What was your life like after that? How was it different?
Well, the first year or so, I had so much energy, I couldn't sleep. I had forgotten what it felt like to be normal. I was so sick for so long. I felt like I was 16 again. It was amazing. I can't even explain it. It was a miracle. It was like winning the lottery, only better. I finally could plan for the future. My goal had always been to see my son graduate from high school. He was 14, almost 15 when I got my transplant. And not only did I get to go to his high school graduation, I got to go to his college graduation, his wedding, the birth of his two sons. And now I live 8 miles away from him and I get to see him and my grandsons all the time. The course of my life totally changed, totally unexpected. Something that I never counted on before. And now I can say, oh, next year we can do this. Or, you know, I'm going to take this trip. I had a career that I never would have had. The list just is infinite.
I hear a lot of my dad's own story in yours. So I got to see, you know, what life was like on dialysis and also that change afterwards, where suddenly like you can plan things, you've got energy to go do things. I did actually want to ask how you think about the sort of weird fact that someone else's death was able to give you life.
I had a lot of survivor's guilt and I sometimes still do because she was so young. And I don't know whether, you know, what if she had kids? They've grown up without their mom. What if she had a spouse that still misses her? You know, I think about those things. I had a transplant coordinator back then who put it to me very well, put it to me in a very kind way, that you have to think of the bigger picture, the bigger plan. She said that person was called home for whatever reason and would have gone anyway, regardless of whether you got those gifts or not. So if it was that person's time, and they made the decision to be a donor, then just accept that gift with all your heart and be grateful. And I truly have to believe that. She sacrificed everything to allow myself and her other recipients to go on. So I'm going to take care of that gift in the best way I can for the rest of my life. And then if there's stuff left over, I don't want to be morbid, but if there's stuff left over when I'm gone, I'm going to be a donor too. For me and what you've done with your dad, that's an incredible gift. I hope you know how much he probably feels indebted to you and grateful to you for the rest of his life. It's not an easy gift to accept either. You're so blessed, both of you. It's a very selfless thing to do.
Well, thanks. I don't know. It just struck me as the right thing to do. Tell me about how you have gone on after that. Tell me about the advocacy work that you've engaged in.
Well, I've been a little out of the loop for the last couple of years. I've had some health issues of my own. And then I lost my husband in June of 22. So that's been rough. But prior to that, I used to love to travel to some of the other towns in Wyoming and have mostly been visiting with people at the donor designation booths at those events and the health fairs and such. I was also able to participate in some transplant science classes, which I would love to go back to doing that. It's just, to me, it's fascinating to see the kids and how they're really into it. The middle school kids and the high school kids. I really enjoyed doing those classes and being able to kind of share my experience. I think that's really cool.
That is really cool. I asked you about some grim things today, but finishing up, I wanted to ask you about what you'll be doing on New Year's Day.
Oh, wow. That's, you know, I always wanted to be famous, but I didn't think it was going to be like this. All kidding aside, though, I get to ride. I have the honor of riding on the One Legacy Donate Life Rose Parade float. I will be honored to be riding on the float with, I think, 17 or 18 other recipients. So I'll be going to Pasadena with a staff from Donor Alliance and my bestie. I get to bring somebody with me, and we'll be celebrating New Year's at the Rose Parade. I can't wait.
Well, Rhonda, thanks for sharing your story with me and for thinking so much about a topic that's really close to my heart.
Regards to your dad, too, and you guys have happy holidays.
Snowhounds, stay tuned. Next, we jump into new winter trends in the state. This is Open Spaces.
Hello, listeners. This is Megan Feary, and this week I'm bringing you the story of a woman who has always turned to the natural world to heal her.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day, and so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
It's a story of love, acceptance, motherhood, and whales. Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Wyoming Public Radio takes you around Wyoming. Listen for interesting stories from down the long streets and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:30 and 4:48. If you have a Wyoming story of interest, you can send it to me at ingel@uwyo.edu. Thanks.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Mom and pop ski resorts are often the heart of small ski towns. They're usually pretty affordable, safe, and not very crowded, lending themselves to being family-oriented, where a lot of kids learn to ski. But what happens when winters become less predictable and there isn't even enough snow to open around Thanksgiving, which has become widely thought of as the start of ski season? How can these resorts afford to stay in business? Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan takes a look.
It's a bluebird day at White Pines Ski Resort, a little two-chairlift ski hill outside of Pinedale. Families are sitting outside eating burgers and fries. Local Kelsey Bailey and her three kids, Axel, Hannah, and Monet, came up for the day to
get our passes for the season and hope that it opens soon.
It's the third weekend in December, and the ski hill isn't open yet. The sun is beaming down with temps in the high 30s, and the snow is sparse. Rocks and grass are poking through everywhere.
Are you guys itching to ski?
I'm cold.
No, itching to snowboard.
Oh, to snowboard. Oh. Yeah. Yes, we're waiting to get up here and play.
So instead, the Baileys came up for the snow dance party. The idea is if you dance enough, the snow just might start falling.
All right, you ready?
You go first.
Well, what if we all go together?
Yeah. You go first.
You want me to go first?
I do it.
Let's see your dance, Axel.
The kiddos stomp their feet and twirl around, looking up at the blue sky.
Let's do it again. Do it again.
Me?
Yeah.
The next closest ski hill to Pinedale is 75 miles away in Jackson. So White Pine is a winter staple for a lot of locals.
We're known as a place to start skiing.
Owner Alan Blackburn looks up at the empty hill. He's wearing a Carhartt jacket and a tweed flat cap.
kids and families is our forte.
Typically, White Pine is open by December 1st. But this year, Blackburn says they can't open yet.
The little road which runs up the hill, normally it's covered, but you can just make it out here. All you do is skiing across it. You just go humpity bump, 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 fall, trip. They could easily come out of their skis and break their leg.
On a normal winter Saturday, White Pine will see a few hundred people skiing. So not being open means none of those tickets are being bought.
The only thing that keeps me sane is the fact that we had a good season last year with all the snow.
Last year saw massive snowfall, bringing lots of skiers out to White Pine. But the couple years before that were a drought, and this one is shaping up to be similar.
I think the ski resort industry is going to suffer because of just variability.
Sophia Schwartz is a professional skier in Wyoming who's with the group Protect Our Winters. They talk a lot about climate change and its effects on the ski industry.
Folks who are looking to plan maybe a holiday vacation might be skeptical about choosing to come to these winter environments because the consistency and the lack of snow.
And she says smaller mom and pop resorts could feel it more than, say, big corporate resorts like Vail or Jackson Hole Mountain Resort.
I'm up here in Jackson and we have kind of a rich, robust ski area and, you know, a budget that allows them to hold on through rough times.
But some smaller ski resorts have figured out a way to hang on too. Snowmaking machines spew out icy snow across Snowy Range Ski Resort, just outside of Laramie. They're locally owned with 5 chairlifts, and they did open December 1st.
What we're open on right now is pretty much all snowmaking snow.
Riley Copeland runs their 11 snowmaking machines that create the man-made snow, a mixture of water, cold temperatures, and high-pressure air. So if snow isn't falling from the sky, it's really not a problem. They have 27 runs, and 13 are open so far. And without making snow?
I mean, we still wouldn't be open right now.
Now, all the major ski resorts are using this type of equipment. But for smaller resorts, affording it can be harder. It can cost a couple $1,000s to make just a foot of snow for 1 acre, or about the size of a football field. For context, Snowy Range is about 250 football fields. But Copeland says it's worth it in the long run. They have on average 2,000 people on a typical Saturday. So not being open...
I mean, that's just money lost without having customers here.
Back at White Pine on the other side of the state, owner Alan Blackburn says maybe they'll open by Christmas.
The groomers are ready, the lifts are ready. Everybody's ready. No, we just need that extra bit of snow.
He says he's looking into investing in snowmaking equipment for next year. It's the only way they can consistently open early and get lift tickets sold.
It will help the employees enormously, and it'll help my pocket as well, because at the moment it's got a big hole in it.
Oh, really?
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Pinedale.
Now, onto a story about another part of the winter world. Snowmobiling is a big part of Wyoming's winter economy. But as the sport grows more popular, what can be done to try and decrease avalanche incidents? The Bridger-Teton Avalanche Center wants to help build a better picture of what's going on with less studied snowpacks in the eastern half of the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman has more on how the center hopes to get local communities involved.
High up on a snowy ridge in the Tetons, Frank Karras and John Fitzgerald have carved out a flat spot in a steep slope so they can see its layers. This helps them better understand the snow's stability. They're in this specific spot because an avalanche was naturally triggered here over a week ago.
ECTP 23. 2 millifacets. Not great. Not the worst.
Karis and Fitzgerald work as forecasters with the Jackson-based Bridger-Teton Avalanche Center. It's part of the Forest Service and provides daily avalanche forecasts and snow and weather data for Northwest Wyoming.
But interesting and consistent to have no failure at that crust, which is what we saw a week ago.
It's the forecaster's job to literally get their hands in the snow to test its stability in many different locations, aspects, and elevations, and to see how it's changed over time.
We've had that sandwich crust, yeah. Facet crust,
yeah.
Down towards the bottom of the pack, but not at the ground.
Crust is not a good word. That usually means the snow is less stable. With this new information, the forecasters now have one more data point for when they provide their professional opinion on the trend of snow stability in this area. But Kara says they only have so many forecasters.
There's basically six forecasters trying to cover 7,000 square miles of forecast area. And each of our mountain ranges have some unique weather and avalanche conditions.
That 7,000 square miles covers the south of Yellowstone National Park all the way down to Cokeville and Hams Fork and from the eastern edge of Idaho to Du Bois. And there's no other professional avalanche forecasting organization for any other part of the state. Dwayne Meadows is the executive director of the Bridger-Teton Avalanche Center Foundation, which raises money for the center.
There are also a lot of blank spaces on the map that are where people are riding and snowmobiling and without an avalanche forecast to say, hey, today the avalanche danger is high or low or considerable or extreme.
Eastern Wyoming is one of those blank spaces. But this year, the center created a new avalanche information exchange page for the area on their website. The page is a place for the public to share and see other community observations for the Bighorn, Sierra Madre, and Snowy Mountains. Kara says people can post things like a photo of a recent avalanche or a crusty layer in the snow, and can view webcams and weather station data.
Before they go out, they can make decisions on what the snowpack may be like. It'll help guide their terrain choices, hopefully.
A lot of the people getting out in those mountain ranges and others throughout Wyoming are snowmobilers, which Meadows says is
arguably the biggest part of Wyoming's winter tourism economy, bigger than skiing. And it provides a lot for a lot of tiny little towns all over the state.
According to a recent report on snowmobile recreation, the number of people visiting Wyoming to ride has increased by almost 40% in a 9-year time period. Meadows says snowmobiler deaths and avalanches have increased over the years, while skiing deaths have plateaued despite increased use.
The snowmobiles are a lot easier to ride, they're lighter and they're faster, and people are getting themselves in trouble.
Of the four people who've died in avalanches in the Snowy Mountains west of Laramie since the 80s, three were snowmobilers. Heather Tupper is a volunteer with the Snowy Range Snowmobile Club. She says the club has a big focus on education, which is especially important given the range is the first one you run into coming west on I-80. Tupper says getting the new avalanche information exchange page on people's radar and creating buy-in will be helpful.
We as a user group can kind of help support this and continue to build legitimacy behind the need for this information and a place to find it.
Will Mook is the co-founder of Mountain Riding Lab, which teaches motorized avalanche education in Wyoming and Idaho. He says education in the field is just now catching up to snowmobiling technology. So, an increase in classes and more on-the-ground data points will ideally keep more people safe in the backcountry.
Hopefully, that's going to turn the bar graphs around, and we're not going to be the user group that has the most fatalities, you know, across the West every year.
Forecaster Frank Karras says the Avalanche Center will also be teaching classes out in the eastern half of the state this winter. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman. What type of holiday events do Wyomingites get excited about? That's up next on Open Spaces.
Do you have a favorite classical music composer? On Classical Wyoming, you can hear the compositions of Grieg, Tchaikovsky, Liszt, and many more played by full orchestras or on solo instruments. And Classical Wyoming is available 24 hours every day. For more information, go to wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This time on The Modern West, Ariel's neighbors all want to know what caused the Marshall Fire. Then a new forensic report comes out confirming climate change isn't just at the door, it just burned the door down.
It's continuously the hottest year on record for us. I had that feeling before I ever had an awareness of the climate doom that would define our lives.
Our Safe Place. It's part three of our series, The Burn Scar. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by the Argosy Foundation.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kodalska. Wyomingites know that the holidays are just around the corner after the first snowflake falls from the sky. Around the state, holiday events like parades, workshops, and light shows happen in almost every town. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Saunders brings us this festive story.
Sounds of car horns and Christmas music can be heard from the streets of downtown Laramie on a recent chilly night. Snow falls from the night sky straight out of a classic holiday movie. People like Charles Bloom are lined up on Ivinson Avenue watching the parade.
Actually, I used to live here in Laramie for 13 years. I've been in Cheyenne for the last five.
He still drives over to watch Laramie's parade, though. Why?
Honestly, it's the people, the energy, the excitement.
Bloom says that energy and excitement comes from the size of the community here.
I mean, they're both great parades, but they're different. This one really is smaller, more community-based, and the Cheyenne one's a lot larger. Still lots of the community there, but it's just a different atmosphere.
Parades are a fairly common way to celebrate, but some towns do more. In Cheyenne, residents can tour the Union Pacific Railroad steam shop, which houses its historic steam locomotives. It's only open a few times a year. Or, for a different kind of horsepower, people can send their letters to Santa on the Pony Express.
Our most popular event is our Pony Express ride at noon and 2 on Saturdays during Old West Holiday.
That's Amber Treviso, Destination Events and Programming Manager for the City of Cheyenne. She helps organize the holiday festivities. She bases them around the town's history.
Well, I can't speak to the other events, but I do feel like it is very specific to Cheyenne and the Old West feel.
And Treviso says there's enough cheer to go around.
Old West Holiday is open to anyone that has the Christmas spirit. So young, old, and everyone in between. It's for everybody.
And while many people put up Christmas lights of their own, some towns have special setups. Sean Clark from Gillette drives through the Festival of Lights every year with his family.
There's a back road that they take. You go through that, and at the very end of it, there's a big light show where you listen to the songs, and we watch a big screen. It has like a little shows and cartoons for the kids that play all of the songs, like Let It Go and like the Hot Chocolate song from Polar Express.
The annual event runs from mid-November through the first week of January. It's made up of over 1 million individual bulbs arranged in around 50 displays.
Honestly, I've never really seen anything like this anywhere else. This is almost like a drive-in movie.
According to the City of Gillette, it's Wyoming's largest holiday lights festival. Back in Laramie, the parade is slowly coming to an end. Children wrapped in blankets scurry off to their parents' cars as snow cloaks the streets. Many are probably headed to do the same thing as parade watcher Charles Bloom.
Honestly, a nice cup of hot cocoa because it's chilly outside.
For many residents, the holidays hold a special place in their lives. And from Gillette to Cheyenne, towns play a big role in how people from around the cowboy state celebrate.
Happy holidays!
Merry Christmas!
Happy holidays!
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Saunders.
This year, we asked our listeners to share special, different, or even weird holiday traditions, and we were not disappointed. The following are a few unique holiday traditions from around the state. First, Connie Owen has a pretty old holiday story she wanted to share. Owen was the director of the Senior Center in Jackson for 26 years and now writes a weekly column for the local paper. Her story is actually her mother's story about Christmas during the Great Depression, written on an old recipe card.
My name is Connie Owen, and I live in Jackson, Wyoming. I'm retired. I'm old. I'm almost 80. This story was written by my mother, Ruth Hartzell Trout, who was born in Evanston and lived there her whole life. She was born in 1923 and died last year at the age of 99. These are her words, the Christmas of 1929. It gives a clear picture of what life was like in Wyoming and our country during the Depression. My father was out of work as there were no jobs to be found during the Depression in 1929. It was tough times for everyone in our nation, and our town of Evanston was no exception. Even the town's top employer, the Union Pacific Railroad, had drastically cut their workforce. I was the middle child, two older brothers, two younger brothers. And I remember how worried we all were that Santa would never find us that year. 2 days before Christmas, our dad received a call on the phone from a local lumberyard to come and help unload a freight car that had just arrived filled with lumber. Christmas morning, we arose to a wondrous sight. In addition to a small gift for each one, we beheld a beautiful two-wheeled bike. We gathered around to read the names of all five children written on the card from Santa. We lived 2 miles from town, and we literally rode the wheels right off that bike. That's it.
That was Jackson resident Connie Owen reading a memory written by her mother about a holiday surprise in Evanston during the Great Depression. Stay with us to hear more holiday traditions from you, our listeners. This is Open Spaces.
Hello, listeners. This is Megan Feary, and this week we have something special for you. Our friends from the Points North podcast have shared an incredible episode with us, and we want to share it with you. It's called No Ice is Safe Ice, and it's something anyone who's been out on the Great Lakes in winter knows well.
My snowmobile started sinking, so I jumped off my snowmobile into the cold water, and I've always been taught you go through the ice out there, it's a death sentence, you know what I mean? Chances are you're not going to make it.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Camila Kudelska. Up next, we continue with holiday stories from our listeners. Laramie local Stuart Shipman's family has a unique tradition that has lasted over 70 years. Take a listen.
In 1949, the first year my parents spent Christmas together, they weren't married. My dad was a sergeant in charge of a motor pool for the occupation army at Camp Hagen near Hachinohe, Japan. My mom was one of the first Department of Defense teachers. So she's teaching the kids of servicemen and support people in Japan. They spent Christmas Eve together. My mom bought a tall red candle, especially for that, and burnt it. And for reasons we don't quite know why, maybe because she grew up in the Depression, save the stub. The romance progressed. Next Valentine's Day, they got engaged. Had to drive 8 miles in a Jeep to the telephone where they could call the states and tell their families. She finished out the school year, went home on the boat to make some preparations, get some stuff ready for their wedding, which was supposed to be in August. Mm-hmm. While she's home, the Korean War breaks out. She's on the boat coming back. My dad's unit's already been sequestered. She can't get in touch. She does this crazy, assertive stuff. They manage to get married on the planned day. Some general has a cottage up on Mount Fuji, lets them use it for their honeymoon. Then he goes off to Korea. So that Christmas, she takes the candle stub from the previous year, buys a new candle, melts them down together, makes two candles. Somehow manages to get one of them to him. So he burns his in his foxhole in Korea. She burns hers at the missionary's place in Japan. The Christmas after that, they're back together. They take the two stubs, melt them together with a new one, make a new candle, burn on Christmas Eve. And that's how it progresses for the most part. You take the stubs from the previous one, melt them with a new one, make a new candle. And all the time there's this narrative going along with it about who's at the site of the Christmas candle being burned. So we're writing this down as children get added to the family. lots of the same addresses. And then, you know, we grew up and children start moving away from the family. So that's also recorded. When that happens, then you have to make multiple candles. So 1975, I think my oldest sister had one in San Diego. The rest of us had one back in Denver. Melt the stubs together, put a new one in, make a new candle. This goes on and on over the years. So the one that I'll burn this year, California, my son's place, has wax from all of these different places, all these different Christmases since 1949. Christmases on 6 different continents, 18 different countries, 17 U.S. states, I think more than 100 discrete addresses.
That was Laramie resident Stuart Shipman sharing his family's holiday tradition of lighting the everlasting red candle on Christmas Eve. Most people in the United States, Christian or otherwise, recognize December 25th as Christmas Day. For Patrick Ivers, a retired math teacher in Laramie, December 25th is a day to remember the discovery of calculus. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor asked Ivers about his unorthodox holiday tradition.
You recognize something called Newton's Mass. Can you tell me about that? What is Newton's Mass?
Sir Isaac Newton was born on December 25th, 1642. And so, since I'm not a Christian, or at least no longer, I celebrate what I call Newton's Mass. And my wife and I have an apple pie. And I send out to all my friends and family my happy Newton's Mass greeting, which is a celebration of Sir Isaac Newton's life and some interesting connections with the holiday season.
So do you do any Christmas stuff too, or is it strictly Newton's Mass?
It's impossible not to do something Christmas because it's what dominates the season here. My wife puts up a wall hanging of a tree that she has ornaments on that she got from Venezuela. So I guess that's sort of Christmas. But I'm pretty much would be a debunker.
So how long have you been doing this?
About 20 years. I wrote a piece about it to the Denver Post at the time, and they published it. And I thought it was unique to me because I'd not come across it. And then I discovered maybe 15 years ago, there was a group in New York City, and they had a little piece in the New York Times. So there are a few others out there like me, but I've never come across anybody personally that celebrates as I do. But when people wish me Merry Christmas, I say Happy Newton's Mass.
Were you actively searching for a secular alternative, or did you just, you know, more come across it?
I just came across it. It was just by happenstance that I was reading something, and I realized, hey, December 25th, I hadn't realized that. So now I've got something else that I can celebrate that's definitely someone who was born on December 25th, because if you follow the scripture, it could not have been late December that Jesus was born. We have shepherds with their flocks, and they don't have flocks out there in the cold of December.
So tell me a little bit more about Isaac Newton. Why should we focus more on Newton and less on nativity?
Isaac Newton, and I should also include Gottfried Leibniz, invented the calculus. So we wouldn't have calculus today, at least not as soon as we have it, if it hadn't been for Sir Isaac Newton, which he came up with it during the plague. He had to leave, I think he was at Cambridge, and go home where his mother was living. And he came up with the calculus, and then he devised the formula for gravity. And then he also did a lot of work with optics. In effect, Sir Isaac Newton's birth was the birth of the scientific revolution.
I think that's everything I've got for you. Is there anything else people should know about Newton's Mass?
No, not about Newton's Mass, but there's something else that I put in my greeting. Sir Isaac Newton, again, was born on December 25th, 1642, and he said he stood on the shoulders of giants. And 50 weeks prior to his birth, one of the greats, Galileo, died on January 8th, 1642. If you go 300 years in advance from that, you reach the birth of Stephen Hawking on January 8th, 1942. Stephen Hawking then, 76 years later, died on March 14th, Pi Day, which coincidentally was also Einstein's birthday. That's an incredible series of coincidences of dates.
Awesome. We'll leave it there.
Thanks, Jeff.
That was Patrick Ivers speaking about his celebration of Newton's mass. For a lot of people, the holidays mean getting a Christmas tree. Usually that means some type of big, bushy, green tree, like a Douglas fir or blue spruce, or even a fake tree. But Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan tagged along with one Sublette County local who went on a hunt for an unexpected type of Christmas tree.
Well, my name is Bill Webb. I've been a resident of Pinedale since about 1976. And spent most of my life in the mountains and exploring the desert up here. It's just wonderful, wonderful country. But today, we're doing a first. We're going to go out and get a piece of sagebrush for a Christmas tree. Okay, well, you'll beat her truck. Go to a secret spot down on the Green River and look for the sagebrush Christmas tree. But this one spot down here, all of the sagebrush is 4, 5, 6 feet, just in one spot. Okay, this is it. I always carry one of these in my saddlebag. It's just a folding saw with a lock blade. It's cut many a pine tree off a horse trail, pine tree branches. Yeah, I think we ought to walk. Well, we can just walk down the road and look at these, but then if we want to get serious, we can just bail and start walking through other stages. A lot of rabbit tracks. Gonna have to cross this fence. That tallest one, you know, there's like three or four growing out of there. I think that one's a keeper. If it takes them a while to cut that, I'll be working up a thirst. Okay. Oh, smell that. I love sage. I'm excited. See how easy this is to cut? I may have to go get a chainsaw. Definitely working up a thirst. There we go. Now see? I don't feel bad about cutting that off since that's a great big plant. It's got a lot of other branches. Okay, last leg of the journey. There we go. So, just loaded up the three sages that we got, and they are so full and bushy, they're taking up the whole bed of this 8-foot-long bed pickup truck. Plus, a few branches are sticking 2 or 3 feet above the top of the cab of the truck. So it's some big sage.
Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan produced that story about Sublette County local Bill Webb getting a sagebrush Christmas tree. And that's it. Happy holidays and New Year's from all of us at the Wyoming Public Radio Newsroom. And thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. The show can also be found wherever you get your podcast. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Hannah Haberman, our producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital producer and social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.